Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-11-599, Vandeveer versus American Savings Bank. Arguing for the appellant, Mark Bennett. Also appearing for the appellant, Brandy Belanda. Arguing for the appellee, John Perkin. Also arguing for the appellee, Brandy Faria. Argument on the merits.
Good morning to both of our groups of attorneys. Are you ready to proceed today? Mr. Perkin? All right, and Mr. Bennett, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so the light will come on, warning you when you have 5 minutes to go. Mr. Perkin, you asked for a warning with 2 minutes to go in your argument. Very well. So we well, let's proceed. Thank you. Mr. Bennett, please, with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This case presents to the Court an issue of federal law. That issue is whether the allegations set forth in the complaint by Mr. Vandeveer solve as a class action.
Could I ask, could we turn off the, there's a fan of some kind in the back of the courtroom. If we could turn that off, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Bennett.
Should I wait here?
I think we're good. Thank you.
This case presents an issue of federal law. Whether the allegations set forth within the four corners of Mr. Vandeveer's complaint solve as a class action are entirely preempted by federal law. Since the clear answer to that question is yes, the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution compelled the Circuit Court, and we would respectfully suggest compels this Court, to reverse and to determine that all of the allegations set forth in the complaint were in fact preempted. The reason this case was brought in Circuit Court in the first place was because of a misapprehension on the part of the plaintiffs. The complaint in this case in paragraph 13, Record on Appeal 15, said, and I quote, ASB is a Hawaii for-profit corporation and state chartered bank. If that had, in fact, been true, we would not be before the Court today. That fact statement in the complaint, as the judge determined in the Circuit Court, was completely untrue. American Savings Bank is a federal savings and loan, cradle-to-grave regulation established by the Congress in the Homeowners Loan Act of 1934, colloquially known as HOLA. Regulated by a variety of entities, starting with, in part, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, but for the purposes of this case, the Office of Thrift Supervision. The Office of Thrift Supervision established regulations governing the operations of savings and loans, which said, and I will quote them later in the argument, all state regulation, case law, statute, or any other kind purporting to affect the deposit-related activities of a federal savings and loan are preempted, that the Office of Thrift Supervision intends to and does occupy the field.
Does a pronouncement by an agency establish preemption?
No, Your Honor. A pronouncement by an agency does not establish preemption. A regulation by an agency, however, does. And this exact question was determined by the United States Supreme Court in Fidelity versus Della Cuesta, 458 U.S. 141, where it's the exact issue raised in this case by Mr. Vandeveer, which is that the Office of Thrift Supervision allegedly did not have the power to preempt, was answered explicitly by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said it was argued in that case, quote, the board has no authority to adopt regulations displacing state law. That was at 458 U.S. at 162. But the questions the Supreme Court in Della Cuesta posed and answered unequivocally established the authority of OTS. What the Supreme Court said is that, first of all, at page 153 of 458 U.S., federal regulations have no less preemptive effect than federal statutes.
But that's a different issue, in fact, whether or not it was preempted. Didn't the court specifically say in that case, we need not decide whether HOLA or the board's regulation occupies the entire field of the Federal Savings and Loan Association regulation?
Your Honor, what the regulations at issue in this case had not been issued yet, but what the court in Della Cuesta said is that at 161, the broad language of 5A of HOLA places no limits at all on the board's authority. It would have been difficult, quoting another court, for Congress to give the board a broader mandate. And what the court said at 160 is, and I quote, in section 5A of HOLA, Congress gave OTS plenary authority to issue regulations governing federal savings and loans. I would respectfully suggest that the court does not have the authority to overturn a regulation of the Office of Thrift Savings because it is a federal regulation with the force of law. While the court would have the authority to declare it unconstitutional, I don't believe that the court has the authority to say we believe that OTS exceeded its powers in adopting this regulation. I believe the Supremacy Clause would bar that. But putting that to the side, Your Honor, in Della Cuesta, the court explicitly said that there were no limits on OTS's authority to adopt regulations, and there is, in this case, no question.
So what do you make of Justice O'Connor's concurrence?
I make, Your Honor, that it's a concurrence, and it doesn't in any way impede or deal with the actual holding of the court, which is that the authority of the OTS is plenary and unlimited, which is why the plaintiff's argument that Wyeth somehow sub silentio overrules Della Cuesta is just simply wrong, because in Wyeth, the court did specifically say at page 580 of 555 U.S., we have no occasion in this case to consider the preemptive effect of a specific agency regulation bearing on the force of law. In this case, there is no question that under 12 CFR 557-11, the OTS adopted a regulation which specifically said that it was OTS, and I quote, hereby occupies the entire field of federal savings associations deposit-related regulations, and that federal savings and loans may exercise deposit-related powers and authorities under federal law to the maximum extent authorized by COLA. But beyond that, Your Honor, the OTS in 557-12 specifically said any law, regulation, whether again as a statute or the common law in any of these fields, is absolutely 100% preempted. Checking accounts, disclosure requirements, or dealing with service charges and fees, which is precisely what the plaintiff in this case is seeking. The plaintiff in this case is seeking, and they put not too fine a point on it in their motion to certify a class action, where it's in the record at 526 and 527. They have said the high-to-low fee ordering in this case violates Chapter 480 and is illegal as a matter of law.
What about misrepresentations, Mr. Bennett? What if there were affirmative misrepresentations beyond the disclosures that might have been required or permitted by federal law? Would there be a cause of action then?
If, Your Honor, there were, like in the Cagetani case, from which Judge Mulway decided in federal court, if there were to a particular individual plaintiff a specific false oral representation, Judge Mulway said that a specific claim for fraud based on a specific oral representation would not be barred. But if what it was, which is alleged here, and if you look again with respect, Your Honor, in their motion for class certification at 527 of the record on appeal, they quote from and attach all of the disclosures. They say all of the disclosures went to all of the plaintiffs, and they say more was required. It's not enough that in these disclosures the plaintiffs were told we can order it however we want, and if we order it high to low, it'll result in a higher fee. What they argued to the circuit court below was that there had to be more disclosures, and it is precisely that which is preempted specifically by 557.12c, disclosure requirements, and 557.12f, service charges and fees. This precise issue, Your Honor, was decided in the multi-state case checking overdraft litigation. And what I would point the court to particularly in that case is the complaint. The complaint in that case is at 2011 Westlaw 7947877. And the plaintiff's complaint in this case is taken almost verbatim from that case. Most of the paragraphs in plaintiff's complaint here are taken word for word from that complaint. There are almost no differences. The causes of action are identical. And what Judge King said in that consolidated multi-state litigation with the precise same complaint as here is that all of the claims are preempted. 880 F sub 2nd 1290, The court finds that plaintiff's claims against Sovereign, which was the defendant bank in that case, bear on activities expressly contemplated by 557.12 and as such are preempted. What is particularly, I think, compelling about Judge King's decision in that case is Judge King also had the multi-state case against National Bank.
What year was that case?
That case was decided in 2012, I believe, Your Honor.
And what was it before, did it apply Dodd-Frank, 1465B?
It did, Your Honor. And Judge King specifically said that Dodd-Frank has come into effect, but Dodd-Frank has no retroactive effect, and that Dodd-Frank does not apply to any of the allegations that occurred before it, and that the case had to be decided pursuant to the OTS regulations that were in effect at the time. And, Your Honor, Judge King specifically made that decision, as has every other court.
If we were to rule that Dodd-Frank was a clarification of existing law, what areas of what are the areas of state law that are not occupied pursuant to subsection B?
Your Honor, there are none. But Dodd-Frank.
There are none?
No. There are no areas of state law that affect any of the matters that are listed in 557-12A through H, which are not completely preempted. And with regard to Dodd-Frank, with respect, Your Honor, Dodd-Frank explicitly said it was changing the law. Dodd-Frank specifically said, with regard to savings and loans, we are going to conflict preemption, a conflict preemption analysis, pursuant to which Judge King, in the National Bank litigation case, said that the exact same allegations were not preempted under conflict preemption law. And Judge King, in deciding the doppelganger of this case, specifically said they are, because the National Bank Act is completely different than HOLA. The National Bank Act, the regulations by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, set up a conflict preemption system under which these identical allegations are not preempted. But Judge King said Dodd-Frank notwithstanding, because Dodd-Frank is irrelevant because it doesn't apply to anything that occurred before the 2011 date when Dodd-Frank took effect.
Are there any cases approaching the United States Supreme Court on this issue, the effect of 1465B?
It sounds like
there's a lot of complaints like this.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, because as far as I am aware, the Judge King's decision, which was the multi-state case, so everything making this allegation would have gone to him.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can determine from Westlaw, at least, that, and looking at the docket, his ruling was not appealed, and his ruling dismissed the case in its entirety. So quite obviously, Your Honor, if the court ruled to the contrary of Judge King, and we would, of course, hope that it wouldn't, there would be a clear conflict with the only federal case that foursquare dealt with this, although in our view, there are other federal cases dealing with almost identical issues in which the preemption result has been the same. We would point the court, for example, to the Silvis case from the Ninth Circuit, in which the court specifically said with regard to lock-in fees on the loan side of the equation that each and every one of very similar allegations are preempted. The court in the Lopez case from the Ninth Circuit of 2002, where they were dealing with overdraft fees, specifically said completely preempted. And even in the Gutierrez case, Your Honor, which the plaintiff seems to rely on, although that dealt with conflict preemption, not the field preemption that is at issue here, the Ninth Circuit in Gutierrez specifically said the high to low fee ordering, which was on the loan side and the deposit side in the National Bank case, was absolutely preempted, although it let misrepresentation claims go forward because of the conflict preemption.
So, in a sense, Gutierrez is exactly opposite of your position because they let the fraudulent conduct claims go forward, and under your view, everything's preempted on its face.
No, Your Honor, because the National Gutierrez was decided with regard to national banks under the National Bank Act, where it's conflict preemption. And as Judge King said in the multi-state litigation, where Judge King had let all the claims go forward under a conflict preemption analysis, that if you look at it under conflict preemption, it's not preempted. But if you look at it under the field or the express preemption that you have here, it absolutely is. But Gutierrez said that even under conflict preemption, it was absolutely preempted with regard to the fees itself. But Judge King, as I said, looking at exactly the same allegations here, held that this was preempted. And Judge King could have done nothing else because of the very clear language of 557-12, where the OTS said, we have all of these regulations, we have all of these areas. In their final rule, they said that there is any doubt at all should always be resolved in favor of preemption. And the reason is clear, Your Honor. The reason for this is because the OTS determined that it would not have savings and loans, as opposed to national banks, regulated with regard to fees and other things, depending upon whether, for example, a judge in Hawaii thought that a particular fee was unconscionable, as my friend Mr. Perkin has alleged, as opposed to a judge in Mississippi who decided that the exact same fee and the exact same disclosure was not unconscionable. And the OTS decided that it needed a national system of regulation with regard to savings and loans such that only OTS would be the entity which would determine whether or not a disclosure, whether or not a fee or anything like that would be illegal. And I would point out that
what kind of enforcement ability does OTS have? If OTS thought that this high to low system that ASB had violated savings and law savings and loan laws or regulations, what enforcement would it have?
Plenary authority, Your Honor, and I would point the court specifically to 12 U.S.C. section 1818B and particularly subsection 6A, where the OTS had the authority to enjoin practices that were illegal, and it had the authority to require banks to make restitution and reimbursement if they felt that the bank was unjustly enriched by an improper practice. And the OTS did exactly that, although it's not in the record, if I may answer the court's question. In the Wood Forest Bank case of 2010, the OTS ordered millions of dollars of reimbursements because of what it believed were improper practices by the bank. And that's the exact statutory scheme that OTS set up. You can complain to us. They had a website where you could complain. You could seek enforcement action.
Has OTS taken any action in this matter?
No, they have not, which is precisely with respect our point. The OTS, although they did issue in the middle of this case clarifying regulations about what banks should or shouldn't do, they never took any action against the American Savings Bank, which is exactly why.
Did OTS say that SNL shouldn't do this?
OTS has said that fees should be reasonable, and OTS changed the rules, I think, in 2010 to require that there be that somebody opt in rather than opting out, but they never ruled that high to low fee ordering was illegal.
But I think in 2005, didn't they issue a statement about it?
If I know what the court is referring to, it's basically the OTS statement with regard to certain kinds of credit card fees and with regard to a UDAP law, perhaps from Indiana or Ohio, Your Honor. And I believe what they said was that many parts of that law, in their advisory view, were in fact preempted. Some might not be, but I think the most germane answer to the court's question is that that all predated the regulations here, which were 98-99, and the final rule under which OTS said, regardless of what we've said in the past, we're establishing these rules now, and here is how they ought to be interpreted, although we would respectfully say that the rules themselves are very clear, as every court that has looked at the question has said.
Okay, I'm referring to an overdraft guidance that discouraged high-to-low sequence.
Was that the 2010 rule, Your Honor?
I think it was a few years earlier. But turning to the Indiana reference that you just made, OTS has already come out and said, hey, we're going to allow a Indiana claim based on their comparable statute to ours to go forward.
With respect, Your Honor, I would say that they said much of the law was preempted, but that this was not with regard to deposit-related activity and predated the 557 CFR here, where they issued the final rule and conclusively said all of these things are preempted.
The lending regulations are nearly identical to the deposit regulations in this area.
Your Honor, there is nothing in the Indiana statute or that law which talked about high-to-low fee ordering, but again, it predated 557 where these regulations were conclusively put into effect, and the regulations specifically said all of these things are absolutely preempted, and if you are on the list of 12, you don't get to 13. With regard to the holding company issue in this case, Your Honor.
Mr. Bennett, before we get there, can I just ask you that there was sort of a suggestion by the trial court that this matter motion might have been premature, but further factual development would be helpful and would ultimately the court wasn't precluding the parties from coming back for it, as I understood it, with regard to this issue. Is that what was unreasonable in your view, or why was that impermissible in your view for the court to take the point of view that it's denying the motion at this time but leaving open the door for the motion to be brought after there's more discovery?
Well, because, Your Honor, the court found that the claims were not preempted as a matter of law, and the court said that we could do more discovery, and if we did it and it changed, we could come back. I would point out to the court, Your Honor, that in the transcript that, on the hearing for interlocutory appeal on August 3rd at page 12, Mr. Perkin basically joined our motion to take an interlocutory appeal. Mr. Perkin said to the circuit court, and I quote, it would be appropriate to let them take an interlocutory appeal, although he asked the court to deny the stay. In their opposition to the motion for interlocutory appeal, pages 2 and 3 of their July 26th motion at pages 611-12 of the record on appeal, they accurately said, Judge, you should deny the interlocutory appeal motion because you have absolutely, positively, 100% ruled that these claims are not preempted. So they argued to the circuit court, you've ruled the claims aren't preempted. The circuit court's ruling, particularly 59, 64, and 65, said that these are not preempted as a matter of law. And the court's order in the interlocutory appeal motion at 13 to 14, the judge said specifically, I agree with you that these are not, that you argued they're on their face preempted, not what I ruled, and if you win the interlocutory appeal motion, then the case as a whole would have to be dismissed. The only discovery, Your Honor, that the plaintiff sought to make under Rule 56F, and I would respectfully appoint the court to the only 56F affidavit that was submitted here at page 473 to 474 of the record was they said, we want to do a little bit more discovery on the holding company. We want to see if they got all the profits. And our argument on that was they could have gotten all the profits in the world, but the holding company claims are preempted under clear Supreme Court precedent in this case, particularly Waters v. Wachovia, 550 U.S. 1, where the Supreme Court said, you don't look at the entity, you look at the activity, and you can't do indirectly what you can't do directly. So if the claim against the particular entity is preempted, you can't, for example, try to bar the subsidiary or get money from the subsidiary because of the actions of the parent.
Mr. Bennett, why doesn't this case involve the reordering of charges on the account, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why isn't this only incidentally related to deposits under 557.13?
Because, Your Honor, you don't, with respect, you don't get to 557.13 because the OTS final rule and all of the cases which have looked at this issue, we think, have said you stop at 557.12. If it's on the 557.12 list, which deals with fees and charges, disclosures, checking accounts, if it's on that list, the state law is preempted and you never get to 513, and that's exactly what the final rule says, as to the way these statutes work.
Mr. Bennett, go ahead.
Go ahead.
There's a lot of cases, and you know that as well, that have decided that the law doesn't impose it. There's a whole series of cases cited in the briefs and by other jurisdictions that go and analyze it under the three steps and don't find the law on its face, imposes requirements.
I have to respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because I believe each and every one of those is distinguishable. The vast majority of them are under the National Bank Act. So virtually every one of them is under the National Bank Act, where the court was applying and required to apply conflict preemption. The Ocwen case in the Sixth or Seventh Circuit with Judge Posner, found many of the analogous claims here preempted, but also said the complaint is such a mess. I can't decide what the plaintiffs are even alleging, so let's have it go back and have a determination made by the trial court what this actually means.
And he was very persuaded that there was no private remedies.
He did say that, Your Honor, but there is a remedy that OTS can't adjudicate disputes, but OTS certainly can order restitution in this case. Again, with the holding company, we would respectfully refer the court to Waters v. Wachovia, State Farm v. Reardon, and the D.C. State Farm case 640F sub 2nd 17, all of which stand for the principle you can't do indirectly what you can't do indirectly what you're forbidden from doing directly. In this case, Your Honor, each and every allegation within the four corners of the complaint is preempted. Fidelity versus Della Cuesta holds that these regulations are valid. We would respectfully say the court does not have the authority to invalidate the regulations, and we would respectfully ask the court to reverse the decision of the circuit court. If the court has no further questions at this time, I would respectfully ask for the ability to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You may, Mr. Bennett. Thank you
very much.
Mr. Perkin, your argument.
I'd like to start out perhaps correcting some of the things that I heard my distinguished colleagues say. There was a question as to whether anything in Dodd-Frank would bear on this issue. And Section 1465, where state law preemption standards for federal savings associations are clarified, it specifically states that this chapter does not occupy the field in any area of state law.
So what are the areas of state law that are traditionally not occupied?
Consumer protection statutes of general jurisdiction, of general application, and indeed state statutes of general application, I believe, across the board.
But isn't there another provision in Dodd-Frank that then, in essence, grandfathers in? This title should not be construed to alter the enforceability of any regulation issued by the director regarding the applicability of state law under federal banking law to any contract entered into on or before July 21st, 2010. So was there not a contract here between Mr. Vandeveer and American Savings Bank that predated 2010? And if so, would that provision not, in essence, or provide that there would not be an applicability of the new Dodd-Frank?
Interesting, Your Honor. The problem is this originally was brought as a motion to dismiss, so there was no discovery whatsoever. The judge converted it to summary judgment because he accepted a fact which was not pled, that this was indeed a federal savings thrift institution. So there's nothing in the record about what the contracts were or what might have been in the contracts. So there's absolutely nothing here that would allow you to say that any of these claims would impair any of the contracts. And going beyond that, if you do not buy the argument.
I thought the allegation of the complaint was that there were standardized account holder agreements presented to its customers on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. That was in paragraph 31 of the complaint. So was that not the theory of the litigation, is that there were standardized take-it-or-leave-it agreements, which would be presumably contracts?
Actually, Your Honor, I would have to say that's not the theory of the litigation. That is a fact and a background fact, but it's not the theory of the litigation. And in fact, I believe from having been involved in some of these cases with other institutions, if we go forward, you will find that American Savings will argue that the contracts allowed them to do this. Let me just cut to one specific point that I think is very important. In the Gutierrez case, which admittedly involves a bank, a Federal Reserve Bank and not a thrift institution, the Ninth Circuit specifically found that misrepresentations that were made were not preempted, although under the federal banking regulations, the other claims were. I would urge you to consider one of the differences between the federal banking system and the thrift system is, as you can read in Gutierrez, there were specific regulations that had been adopted by the Comptroller of the Currency. What we have here, and I would urge very strongly, is preemption by hand waving. They simply say, we are preempting all state law, but the other side has not pointed you to any specific regulations they adopted that are regulating in this area. And indeed,
with respect to the fee, overdraft fee regulations, what kind of regulations are there that regulate overdraft? Is it, are there regulations that regulate when overdraft fees can be charged, or are there regulations that regulate the amount of fees? Are there any regulations with respect to overdraft fees?
Your Honor, I can't pretend to be an expert in banking, but what I do know and understand is that the regulations essentially, well, let me step back. Before there's an overdraft fee, the bank has to pay an item. And if there's no money there, the bank gets to say, look, sorry, and not pay it. So these fees apply to instances where the bank decides to pay an item, although no money there, and then for that it charges an overdraft fee. Part of what is now in place is that in order to be able to do that, the institution has to, the customer has to specifically opt in. They have to agree to that arrangement. And as another point, which I think is worth considering, American Savings is not doing this reordering anymore. Indeed, I don't believe any of the banks are doing it. So by this case proceeding, there's nothing that we're going to do that's going to affect the conduct of the savings and loans.
So you're saying, yes, even though OTS didn't, Mr. Bennett said OTS didn't say, didn't stop this, you're saying that they voluntarily stopped it?
No, they stopped it after the suit was filed.
Oh, well, okay.
so.
Mr. Perkin, would you be satisfied with having only your 480 claims survive?
Your Honor, that's interesting. And of course, I have co-counsel who get very mad at me and indeed beat me about the head and shoulders when I say things like this, but I believe that that is the essence of the case. It's a consumer case, and that's the consumer protection statute. And while I firmly believe there were misrepresentations made, I'd rather not have to prove all of the elements of a fraudulent misrepresentation. And since 480 gives us, you know, there's no necessity of proving reliance, it's an easier case.
So what are the misrepresentations beyond the disclosure, the written disclosures themselves? Because there would seem to be, like Gutierrez would seem to suggest, if there are misrepresentations
beyond what is required in the disclosure, that those might be actionable. I think Mr. Bennett has acknowledged there's some cases where oral misrepresentations, the Cagetani case, were found to be actionable. Is there anywhere in your complaint where you allege misrepresentations other than those in the disclosures?
I believe there is. I believe that if you look at paragraph 60 of the complaint, you will see that certain of the certain things are alleged with regard to affirmative misrepresentations. But more than that, again,
failed to notify, never notified in paragraph 60. So it's a failure to disclose.
That would appear to be. However, if you look at paragraph 67C, it states that the out of the overdraft fees was disclosed in an ineffective, ambiguous, misleading, and unfair manner. The account documents provide the customers ambiguous, deceptive, unfair, and misleading statements.
None of this has been fleshed out.
Hasn't been fleshed out,
That's going back to the Chief Justice's question. I mean, the judge said this could be refiled.
Absolutely. And the judge was absolutely clear that he was denying the motion without prejudice. And I believe he specifically indicated that they could bring it again. But if we had a record, it would be easier for all of us, and I would be able to answer these questions. Mr. Chief Justice, I have actually had an opportunity to use Google. Believe it or not, I actually can. And there are advertising materials out there which look to me to be misleading and deceptive, that misrepresentations, I believe, were made, but it's not in the record because of the way the case was disposed of. And if we go back down, we can develop the case. And I also think it's possible that
some of the disclosures may not even have been in compliance with OTS regulations. Isn't that a possibility? I mean, the record is so devoid of anything.
It is very much so, although I have to say that most of the OTS regulations can be very disappointing. In oral argument today is the first time that ASB has said, oh, well, there was a remedy, or there is a remedy for these consumers that's given by the OTS. They can't file a complaint. They can't bring any sort of action. But, actually, at this point, there's not a whole lot they can do.
Did Congress ever say anything like, we want to wipe out all individual remedies? Is there anything like that in the legislative
No,
issue?
Absolutely not. And that's the issue. Essentially, their position is that American Savings Bank, because it is a thrift, was completely immune to all Hawaii consumer laws and statutes. And if our citizens were mistreated, were treated in an unfair and deceptive manner, that's just too bad. It's tough.
Can you explain again what it is exactly happened here? How are you saying that they would do the high-low over the course of several days, or was it just one day?
My understanding is, again, because there was no actual discovery in this case, I don't have as much knowledge of American savings practice, but what I have seen with regard to Bank of Hawaii, Central Pacific Bank, cases that were filed and have been settled, indeed, they hold them for days. Another problem is, and again, not everything was spelled out in the complaint with particularity, but people would, if you put your cash card, your bank card, into the cash machine, it would show that you had a positive balance if you wanted to take some money out. What it wouldn't tell you was that was an overdraft. So actually, I have to tell you, I think it's a misrepresentation for somebody like me, and I'm a pinhead about math and that sort of stuff. But if I, you know, put my card in, half the time I hit balance first, and it tells me I got, you know, X $100, I'm going to take some money out. There's nothing that would indicate that that was going to be an overdraft or there would be an overdraft charge. I mean, just that, it seems to me, is a misrepresentation.
Counsel, the bank argues that administrative relief of restitution and reimbursement is adequate. In your view, is that an adequate remedy to anyone who's aggrieved by the practice of the bank?
Well, actually, I must say, no, in my view, it's not an adequate remedy, but I'm not absolutely sure how you get there, first of all. But second, that would be on an individual consumer basis. And if you did get it, that would be it, the restitution. This has been filed as a class action for a good reason. This is another one of those where most people, I mean, there's not enough damages individually per plaintiff to make it worthwhile for them to go to Washington and try to file some administrative complaint, which has no adjudicatory mechanism for it, by the way. It's just entirely impractical. It is, in practical terms, no remedy at all. So I think that that's a significant fact. I don't believe, and as Congress clarified the law with Dodd-Frank, I don't believe they ever intended to preempt all state consumer protection statutes. And especially where, as here, there's really nothing that American Savings Bank has pointed to. There's no affirmative regulation on the part of the Office of Thrift Supervision that our complaint attacks. I mean, what they are saying is they are free of any legal duty based upon, as I said, the preemptive handling of the Office of Thrift Supervision. I believe that that shouldn't and probably isn't the law. And another question which came up, which I thought was very good, sorry, I'm not being patronizing, but I believe that some of these cases are being appealed. That, as we all know, it takes a very long time for these to wend through the system. But, you know, the Ninth Circuit decision on Gutierrez came down after this case had been filed. I had been very pleased by the district court decision of Gutierrez, and the Ninth Circuit literally pulled it back. I mean, they
what is the status of that? Was there an application for cert or en banc?
It wasn't en banc. I don't know if there's been any application for cert at this point. And if there was, of course, we know that they're not necessarily granted. But
What's your answer to Mr. Bennett's argument that Congress intended a uniform national system of regulation? If we adopt the approach suggested here by you, in essence, we would have been, or we would be, effectively disapproving the high-low methodology of crediting accounts, disapproving the disclosures that were made. While there is a federal court in Florida, which I guess had a multi-district litigation centered there, which appears to have ruled on exactly the same matters and found that they were preempted. And or if it's not preempted, then you would have various states ruling in different ways. So I guess it's a two-part question. One is, what's your answer to, or what's your critique of that Florida case? And secondly, how would we, how would you answer Mr. Bennett's question about a lack of uniformity of regulation if claims of this kind go forward?
Okay. First of all, with regard to the Florida case, I have read it. As a matter of fact, I have it in front of me right now. And if you read that case, you'll see that the plaintiff's claims were limited. They were limited to the sorts of claims that the Ninth Circuit found were preempted, disallowed. But there was no claim in there of misrepresentation. So even that Florida case does not support the proposition that misrepresentation claims outside of the...
Did that case allege consumer protection, UDAP-type statutes?
Let me see. Breach of contract, unconscionability, conversion, unjust enrichment, and violation of the Maryland Consumer Protection Act. But I guess within that ambit, according to the court, there was no allegation that actually misrepresentations had been made as opposed to inadequate disclosures, for example. So that does not end the matter. I would
that kind of comes back to my question. What are the misrepresentations? In other words, would you concede if we followed the analysis of that court that the high-low method itself and the disclosures themselves would be preempted? And what you're saying is there could be misrepresentation claims beyond the disclosures or distinct from the disclosures.
Yes.
And what would your misrepresentation claims be? Are they articulated in the complaint?
They are not spelled out in the complaint, Your Honor, and I will admit that. And if I had had all of them in front of me.
Does HRCP 9B apply to misrepresentation? You have to spell out misrepresentation as in fraud.
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. The courts have split on that as to whether under 480-2, under the deceptive hook, that it has to be played with particularity. I think it's slightly 50-50 in the it is not a fraud pleading, but there are courts that have held that it is. And at that point, obviously, we'd be subject to a motion to dismiss for failure to plead with sufficient particularity. But by the time we had a chance to do some discovery, I believe we could plead with particularity. And hopefully, we'll do so. I can't promise you that I'm getting a little old, but I'll be here. But I know that someone will, and I know my co-counsel are young, vigorous, and very active. But yes, once again, premature. It was just, it was too soon.
But did you file a 56F motion on these issues? Sir Bennett says it was only with regard to the corporate form.
In fact, there was no 56F motion filed because originally this was a motion to dismiss. And it was only after the issue came up that it might be converted to a motion for summary judgment. We did file one 56F affidavit concerning the holding company. But we did not file one. And in truth, Mr. Chief Justice, I believe the standard for 56F affidavits is you have to use particularity in there. It's not enough to say, well, gee, we haven't had any discovery, so we don't know anything. So we just want to go out there and thrash around. And at that point, again, at the complaint stage, we don't have the information that would be necessary because by the time you get to a motion for summary judgment, generally, there's been sufficient discovery on both sides to develop the issues of the case. Here, none of those were developed. I believe that all of that militates towards finding that the trial judge did just fine. He did the right thing. in saying, I'm denying this without prejudice. Now, I was aghast at myself, as Mr. Bennett was quoting, that I said, maybe an interlocutory appeal is a good idea. I couldn't even tell you what I might have been thinking at that stage, although it might very well have been that, as I'm arguing here today, that this honorable court would find that indeed it was premature to even look at the issue of summary judgment.
Isn't the flip side virtually if the judge says, look, at this point in time, I'm going to deny the motion, I'm going to allow you to refile it. Isn't that, in a sense, almost granting a 56F by saying, look, I want you guys to go do more discovery, take the case farther, and then come back here if there's a... I mean, it's not explicit, but it's implicit, in a sense.
Well, unlike yourself, Justice Pollack, and indeed the other justices, Chief Justice, I've never been a trial judge. They've never been prudent enough to even consider appointing me to the bench. So I couldn't really swear what might have been in the judge's mind. But I do know that he emphasized that he was ruling without prejudice. And that means, as we all know, come on back when you've got something more. And there was nothing that was going to stop them from doing it. So that's the basic framework. I mean, what they're saying is not don't disturb an intricate scheme of federal regulation of these matters on the part of the Office of Thrift Supervision, because no such intricate scheme ever existed. But
cannot the regulatory agency basically say we're regulating these areas and then choose to leave them essentially unregulated?
That preemption by hand waving is not what I've seen before.
No, you can basically say we're occupying the field with regard to disclosure and then choose not to promulgate any regulations regarding disclosure. I'm not saying it's a smart system. I'm not saying it's a good system. Is it? But can they not do that?
I would argue that if they were being given express preemption, that would have been in the enabling statute. If they were actually to occupy the entire field without doing anything, I mean, sort of an adverse possession without possession, that would be in the enabling statute, and it's not.
Didn't Weiss almost address that? It said something like the presumption against preemption thus accounts for the historic presence of state law but does not rely on the absence of federal regulation. In other words, the absence of federal regulation, you can't just announce it. You can't preempt state law by just making an announcement.
That's the way I read Weiss, Your Honor. I believe that's correct. And I don't believe that Congress intended that these agencies should just be able to toss out wholesale state consumer protection statutes which were passed for the protection of our citizens, simply by saying away with them. If they want to occupy the field, if they want to come in, promulgate regulations, that's a whole different thing. And you're getting into conflict preemption. But there's no, as I said, there's no hand-waving preemption. And by the way, as of Dodd-Frank and its associated consequences, the whole game's changed. I mean, this is not going to be what's going to be happening going forward. And I think we've all lived through enough over the last decade or two to know that our legislature and all of us have decided that the supervision with regard to financial institutions was probably not flawless. And so we're going into a new system anyway.
And the defendants argue that there's not a single federal court case that's allowed claims similar to this to be asserted against a savings and loan. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, Your Honor, I'm sitting here thinking about it. I'm trying to remember that Judge Posner's decision. Was that a bank or
something? Aquan. Hmm? The Aquan case.
Yes. So was that a savings and loan or a bank? I hesitate.
I think it was a lending case.
I think it was. I think it may have been a savings and loan. But No, otherwise, I can't, off the top of my head, think of that, but that at all.
One would think, and let me just ask your impression about this, one would think that if there really was this concern that all these state consumer statutes would cause havoc in the regulatory scheme, why would Dodd-Frank say, hey, we're not preempting state law? Isn't that kind of like saying, hey, this isn't this huge potential nightmare that you folks are arguing, by saying, look, we specifically are not preempting state law?
And I would also suggest that by labeling that one provision a clarification of existing law rather than an amendment or modification, Congress was saying, we never meant that in the first place. That this should never have been taken as gospel, that there was no such preemption. I see that my two-minute warning is on, so unless there are any further questions, I'll head for the sidelines.
There's nothing further. Thank you very much, Mr. Perkin. We appreciate
thank
it.
You, Jim,
thank you.
And thank you, Justices.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Bennett, your rebuttal. No, I think Mr. Perkin has completed his argument. He had.
I don't think I did rebuttal.
We don't have sir rebuttal here, so Mr. Perkin is done with his argument.
I apologize, Your Honor. I thought they indicated Ms. Berea was going to argue too. First, Your Honor, with regard to hand waving or preemption, federal regulations have exactly 100% precisely the same preemptive effect as an act of Congress. In this case, the Office of Thrift Supervision, in its regulations, occupied the field and said it was doing it in exactly the same way the Congress could. It has exactly the same force of law. The court could no more ignore the Office of Thrift Supervision regulation, which said this is field express preemption, then this court under the Supremacy Clause could ignore an exactly the same act of Congress.
Let me ask you what I asked Mr. Perkin. What regulations, if any, has OTS issued with respect to when overdraft fees can be charged?
They haven't, as far as I know, issued regulations as to when they can be charged. They issued guidance on opt-out and disclosures, and they have a regulation 550.380 CFR, which says that all fees have to be reasonable.
But those all came later, in 2010.
The 550.380 has been there all the time. All the rest of them came later.
What's 550.380 again?
It says the fees that you charge in any area have to be reasonable.
Okay.
With regard to Wyeth, Your Honor, with respect, Wyeth did not change the law when either Congress or an agency has said there is field preemption. There is nothing in Wyeth that does that. There is field preemption here, and while, with regard to the Chief Justice's question, or a question about wouldn't it be okay if the 480 survived, it wouldn't, with respect, comply with federal law, because you don't look at the vehicle, you look at the effect. And if the effect of 480 or any other state statute would be to say you can't do high to low, or here are the disclosures you have to make, each and every one of those would be preempted.
What about misrepresentations over and above the disclosures? So Mr. Perkin, for example, hypothesized you go to the ATM and it tells you you have a $100 balance. In fact, the way the bank calculates these things, you don't. Why isn't that the equivalent of an oral misrepresentation of the type that Judge Mulway found was actionable, although it's coming up on a computer screen?
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is 527 at the record, they said the reorder provisions in their motion for class certification are all exactly the same. Everybody got the same disclosures. They were all in writing. And they didn't make that argument, Your Honor. There is nothing in the record or the complaint that says there are oral or other misrepresentations of this type. They didn't make a 56F motion for that. But if the court were to say everything on the face of the complaint is preempted, but we will let the judge, or we will allow you to amend to try to bring something within the line of individual allegations by Mr. Vandeveer or something else of oral misrepresentations or individualized misrepresentations, Your Honor, that certainly would be within the court's discretion.
Does 9B apply to misrepresentation claims?
We never made that argument, Your Honor. Our only argument was everything that they alleged in the complaint was preempted, which was all that we could, because okay. That was all that was in the complaint.
Did you say that the opt-in regulations do not apply here? They came after?
They came after, Your Honor. And finally, if I may, although my red light is on.
You can finish the very briefly finish your thoughts.
Just very briefly, Your Honor. With all due respect, Mr. Perkins is just simply wrong on Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank changed the law with regard to changing field preemption, conflict preemption, and the Milofsky case in the Sixth Circuit and the multi-state litigation case here make it absolutely clear that the OTS field preemption regulations are 100% applicable to everything that happened prior to Dodd-Frank. We would respectfully ask the court to reverse.
Thank you very much to both of our counsel here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.